This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello to you. We're glad to have you listening in today. I'm Joel Hilliker. Recently, Georgia's lawmakers passed legislation trying to eliminate voter fraud in their state. Common sense laws like requiring photo ID to vote. A recent Associated Press poll showed 72% of Americans favor requiring photo ID to vote. But Major League Baseball protested by moving its All-Star game out of Atlanta. They moved it to Denver, Colorado. The CEO of Delta Airlines, Georgia's largest employer, blasted Georgia's new voting law, calling it racist to require the same sort of ID to vote that Delta requires for passengers to check in. This reflects a growing trend today, social change that is being driven by businesses. CEOs are championing far-left causes. In our latest Trumpet edition, the May-June 2021 edition, we have an article by Richard Palmer titled, "Why Are the Wealthy Woke?" And we're seeing more and more evidence of this trend, more and more headlines all the time showing just how common it has become. We'll start today's show with a conversation with Mr. Palmer about this. Then we'll talk about the latest victim in the radical left's cancel culture, the famed physicist Sir Isaac Newton. An affluent prep school dropped Newton's name from his famous laws of motion. We'll hear a report from Andrew Miller explaining why the left hates Isaac Newton. In our third segment, we'll hear a report from Trumpet writer Rufaro Manyepa about a military junta in the Southeast Asian nation of Myanmar. This bloody situation is quickly growing worse. The military has taken over from a democratically elected government and implemented a brutal crackdown that has killed hundreds of innocent people, including children. We'll see how other nations are getting involved and how this could shake things up in Asia. Then we'll finish today's program with a last word about how important it is that we civilize our children. But let's start by looking at this trend of far-left wealthy people. For this, we have via Skype from our office in Britain, Trumpet writer Richard Palmer. Hello, Richard.
Good afternoon.
So I started by giving a couple examples of how big businesses are pushing these far-left causes. And by big businesses, in a lot of cases, you're talking specifically about the CEOs of these businesses. I mentioned Delta Airlines criticizing Georgia for this election law, and that came straight from the CEO. His name is Ed Bastian. He made $17 million in 2019 for his job at Delta. And this is not an isolated case. If you could just give us a sense of how widespread this trend is.
Yeah, in some ways, I almost wish that I hadn't written this article for this Trumpet print, because there's so much more material if I were to be working on it right now. We've had this trend explode. But, you've got Nike, you've got Pepsi, Lego last year was withdrawing Lego sets that had police officers in it. Disney is quite prominent in the culture wars now, firing a popular actress because of her views expressed on Twitter. You see it all. Most recently, there's been a big furore with one of their villains, one of their Marvel villains is pretty much modeled on Jordan Peterson. You've got Pfizer, Comcast, Home Depot. I remember going through all these examples. Starbucks, they've all gone down in this direction. You've got things like Morgan Stanley. You've got the whole finance sector refusing to deal with people like Donald Trump or process donations for him. So it's consumer businesses, it's financial services, it's all over the kind of the Fortune 500 and these big companies.
So why are they doing this? What is driving this trend?
Yeah, I think there are a couple of different trend pushes here. I mean, if you look at one of the companies that has been most aggressive and really led the way, you're looking at Nike, or I guess in America they call it Nike, don't they?
We do. We call it Nike, and we laugh whenever we hear you say Nike.
Yep. Okay. Well, Nike's probably more close to the Greek god or mythical figure that it's named after anyway. But you know, they've led big on this, and it's really paid off. Just last week, Piper Sandler put out a survey into teens' preferences, and Nike absolutely dominated. Top clothing brand, 27% say that Nike was one of their favorites. The American Eagle is in second place on just 7%. You know, they're head and shoulders above everybody else. Top footwear brand with 56% supporting them. The company number two place was just 12%. And you look at some of the social attitudes on the same survey, showing 20% of these young people were behind racial equity. It was the top social cause. So Nike have really blown it, have done very well for themselves in a marketing sense by championing social justice causes. They're deliberately going after a demographic that really believes in these social causes, and they're making a killing doing so. They're absolutely dominating sales to this bracket. So, I mean, if you look at who businesses want to appeal to, generally it's younger consumers, it's urban consumers, it's often university-educated consumers. You look at who they want to hire, it's the same. They're looking for young, urban, university-educated workers. And you can go through survey after survey, and that demographic is overwhelmingly left-wing. So from that point of view, it makes good business sense to go after the left, even for companies like Delta. You know, remember a couple of years back, they canceled their deal with the NRA, and the Republicans in Georgia were going to punish them by getting rid of the sweetheart deal that Georgia gives the airline. And I think they did. And then the Democrats very quietly put it back shortly afterwards, and they didn't suffer at all. Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot of these companies kind of have twigged that they're not going to be punished from the right. And if they are, it will be a token punishment. But there are big rewards that can be reaped by appealing to the left.
Now, this is a really important point that you're making, and I'm sure that this will come up more in the conversation as it progresses. But the alignment, the political alignment between the left in America and these companies, they're brandishing these companies as a weapon to put across their agenda in a way that they can't necessarily do within legislatures and politically. It's probably dangerous to underestimate just how much influence these companies can have. I saw an article that is talking about this Zoom meeting that several top CEOs held over this past weekend. It was like 90 business leaders and 30 other experts and aides, and they're talking about how they want to punish states over new restrictions in voting laws and so on. They're threatening to withhold campaign contributions and punish these states. We're not going to build factories in your states. We're not going to build stadiums and that type of thing. You know, for the political left in America to have these kinds of influential voices on their side is really a powerful weapon that they have.
It's huge, and it's probably only just getting – I think we're probably only just starting to see the implications of that. I mean, look at Parler. How hard would it have been for Congress to shut down a website? I mean, that would have been just about impossible, and there's so many legal hurdles and things like that. Whereas you probably only needed to get four or five people to agree, and boom, they're gone. You know, the heads of Amazon, Apple – well, Amazon alone can take down almost all that they do, but Apple and Google, they're gone. Or, you know, if Visa, MasterCard, and American Express decide they're not going to process payments for you, if you're any kind of a business or anything, you're done.
Yeah.
Or a politician even accepting donations. And, yeah, you know, there are checks and balances on government because America's founders knew that power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts. Absolutely. We have to be careful who we give power to, and there has to be checks to make sure that it's not misused. But what checks and balances are there on companies if they start acting in concert like this? I mean, there's a free market. There's the fact that you could walk away, I guess, and go somewhere else. But I mean, that didn't save Parler. When you have just such a small number of very powerful companies that all think alike dominating the market. And yeah, there's there if that's the case, if these companies are working together or thinking the same way, there just aren't the same checks and balances that there are on Congress. Right. So, yeah, absolutely. A huge amount of power. And so yeah, if they're going to start cutting off people like this, where does it end? The tech companies we've talked about a lot, if they start to shut down your website, you can be finished pretty quickly. But then, we're going to not do business in your states and things like that. We've not really lived in this world before. It's unprecedented.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this point too about just how they're only facing punishment from the left. You have what a lot of people would see, I think accurately so, as a conservative silent majority in America that they're not interested in boycotting and protesting in the same way that the left is. And so they don't face that same kind of punitive action by holding the line on some of these points. I think it's also interesting, there was a report that just came out, the fact that the median pay for the CEOs this last year, this is as there's been so much economic disruption within the nation and so many people who've lost paychecks and so on. The median pay for CEOs was $13.7 million last year, $13.7 million for these folks. And that actually is up from $12.8 million the year before. So even as a lot of people are suffering, their pay continues to go up in the middle of all of these problems.
Well, if they're going to govern us as well as run businesses, then more jobs. I guess they need a pay rise. But yeah, I think it is. You make a in some ways, I think some of these businesses are terrified of the left, or it's done in fear of the left. Not exclusively, but if you're a business, who are you more afraid of in terms of regulating you? It's the Bernie Sanders of this world. And some people have put this forward as another explanation of why the businesses are behaving that way, that, you know, it doesn't hurt their bottom line much to support these far left social causes. It does hurt their bottom line to support some economic causes, you know, high taxes, high business taxes, things like that. And so some have speculated that they're hoping they get a free pass on some of these other things. And I can see, you know, even say shutting down Parler, I'm sure a lot of that is ideological. I'm also sure a lot of that is part of that is Amazon fearing being regulated more by the government in terms of what they do. So they're doing some of it preemptively.
Yeah.
But then, I think there are multiple things at stake here. There is, we're doing it in fear. We're doing it out of self-interest. You look at what happened to Gillette after they did their pretty infamous ad about, you know, bashing all men and things like this. They did take an $8 billion write down. So it did hurt their bottom line. Sometimes I think they cross a line and the silent majority does hit back. But I think for a lot of CEOs as well, there's a sincere belief. They come from the same environment as the radical left, you know, the same universities, the same, we're smart, we can fix it. Mm-hmm. We need experts to be in charge. You know, they're in the same milieu. And so they share many of the same ideas. So there's a number of different things that go into this alignment between radical left and big business.
You know, just to underscore the point about how it's profit driven, not necessarily ideological, is the fact that in so many of these cases, while these wealthy people are decrying the evils within American society, they ignore far worse injustices that are taking place in China, for example, where there's a huge market that they can make a whole lot of money from. They're very happy to ignore those problems while they're speaking out against just much, much minor or even invented problems within America. But this point that you're making about just the benefit that they actually stand to gain, this is a point that you make in your article that I think is very important, that they regulation and big government actually benefit these corporations. Can you explain how that is?
Yeah, you look at a lot of pieces of regulation and you'll find that it's big business that wants it. Now, government can regulate in ways that hurt business, and I think there are specific pieces of regulation that maybe they do oppose. But in general, if you're a big company, it's a tiny percentage of your turnover to hire lobbyists, to hire lawyers, to hire experts to make sure you comply with the law or to be defended if the government comes after you. If you're a mom and pop store, you can't afford any of those. And so you know, regulation favors big business over small. It's a massive hurdle that a lot of small businesses can't get over. And, you know, it's, I mean, this is something that's got to be on our radar, I think, after the last 12 months in where the way that COVID regulations have shut down mom and pop stores but kept Walmart and Target open. You know, government in the economy favors big business. And so sure enough, we find government, we find business right behind these regulations. I think we're very familiar with over here in the UK, where we used to be part of the EU, where big business loves the EU for exactly this reason. It creates all of these rules that make it almost impossible for small, lean competitors that could otherwise eat their lunch, just can't get off the ground. And in this way, regulation hurts everybody, because then we all end up having to pay more. We all end up with big, bloated companies. I saw a stat somewhere in the banking crisis in 2008 where nobody had set up a new bank for 100 years. Because there's so much regulation involved, they can't do it. And what do we end up with? We end up with banks with all kinds of dodgy relationships with government officials and causing problems for the entire economy. So, yeah, big businesses love regulation so much of the time. And, yeah, that's another way that they mesh so nicely with the radical left.
What does biblical prophecy say about this trend, Richard?
Yeah, this really is what drove me to write this article. I mean, if you've been listening to this show, you've been reading the Trumpet magazine, so much of what we've been talking about in recent months revolves around the Book of Amos. There's a lot of specific prophecies in Amos talking about the current political situation. You know, everything that we're watching about American politics right now is really informed by that book. And what I think is fascinating is that book also has so much to say about the rich and about the wealthy. And so this is why I was writing about this subject last month, before we really saw this, some of the most egregious examples of this. You know, Amos is there. Well, the Anchor Bible Dictionary writes about him. He decries the social injustice, the oppression of the poor, the lack of any moral or ethical values on the part of the rich and powerful. According to Amos, the spokesman of God, Israel was a violent, oppressive, and exploitative society. And a lot of what he focuses on is, you know, unfairness, twisting the system, you know, forcing people into slavery for trivial debts, falsifying weights and measures, trading dishonestly, courts being corrupt, and you know, judges being influenced by money and siding against the poor. And you know, this is exactly the kind of thing that we see in America. And so many of Amos's prophecies are they're about the wealthy. They're about people that do that. You know, he talks about those that are at ease, those that live an easy life. And have we ever lived an easier life than modern Britain and America? I mean, that's not just the super rich. That's all of us. He talks about those that live an easy life but aren't really concerned with the country being destroyed. And is there a better description than what we see in Britain and America? Absolute catastrophe in so many different ways. You know, even the political situation, the idea of free and fair elections themselves under assault, and most don't really care because we're pretty at ease. And so, you know, there's a lot in Amos that talks even about the super rich, those that have multiple houses, they're condemned. But really, society as a whole, and there's correction for all of us in there, and very specific correction about wealth and our relationship to it.
Well, it's a fascinating trend to watch unfold, and we appreciate the perspective that you provide for us here. We've been talking with trumpet writer Richard Palmer about the wealthiest people championing far-left causes. He wrote an article for our latest print edition of The Trumpet titled, "Why Are the Wealthy Woke?" And it is available at thetrumpet.com. Read that to get a deeper insight into some of those prophecies that he was describing. It's a great study, and we really appreciate your time, Richard.
Great to talk to you.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Science is supposed to be an objective, impartial field of study, but increasingly the radical left is attacking it. And also one of the most important founders of modern scientific thought, as we will now hear in this report from Andrew Miller.
Cancel culture is getting worse. From Abraham Lincoln to Donald Trump, the radical left is using woke ideology to push victims down the memory hole. And their latest victim is Sir Isaac Newton. A report from Barry Weiss entitled "The Miseducation of America's Elites" reveals that an affluent prep school has dropped Newton's name from his famous laws of motion. "We don't call them Newton's laws anymore," a student told Weiss. "We call them the three fundamental laws of physics. They say we need to decenter whiteness and we need to acknowledge that there's more than just Newton in physics." Other schools have demonized capitalism and indoctrinated students in critical race theory and canceled words like father and mother in favor of gender-neutral terms. But the attack on Newton exposes the roots of the radical left's hatred for free markets, Western culture, nuclear families, and biblical virtues. Most high school students learn about Newton's laws of gravitation, but few study the life of Newton himself. The left say that they are canceling Newton to decenter whiteness from physics, but their disdain for the father of modern science is rooted in a prejudice other than anti-white bigotry. In The Mathematical Principles of Natural Philosophy, Sir Isaac Newton laid out in mathematical terms the principles of time, force, and motion that have guided the development of modern science. Yet unlike most scientists who memorize his equations, Newton was also an avid student of the Bible who wrote on several occasions that God has created everything by number, weight, and measure. Newton was also a student of Bible prophecy who understood that the kingdom of Charlemagne was a prophesied resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. And he wrote in his observations upon the prophecies of Daniel and the Apocalypse of St. John that prophecy would not be fully understood until the time of the end, when the gospel must first be preached in all nations, before the Great Tribulation. These views about God and the Bible are anathema to today's progressive left. The primary reason progressive educators hate Newton is because he believed in absolute truth. The belief that the universe is governed by rational and understandable laws is often called Newtonianism. And philosophers contrast Newtonianism with Darwinism, the philosophy that the universe evolves over time. President Woodrow Wilson, a key figure in progressive history, believed a chief source of conflict in the future would be whether the Constitution of the United States was interpreted in a Newtonian or a Darwinian manner. In his essay, What is Progress?, he wrote, "The makers of our federal constitution read Montesquieu with true scientific enthusiasm. The constitution was founded upon the law of gravitation. The government was to exist and move by the virtue of the efficacy of checks and balances. The trouble with this theory is that the government is not a machine, but a living thing. It falls not under the theory of the universe, but under the theory of organic life. It is accountable to Darwin, not to Newton. It is modified by its environment, necessitated by its task, shaped to its functions by the sheer pressures of life." So in other words, constitutional originalism is rooted in the static scientific doctrines of Sir Isaac Newton, while living constitutionalism is rooted in the evolving morality of Charles Darwin. Wilson believed in living constitutionalism, therefore he advocated abandoning Newtonian theory in favor of Darwinian theory, at least in the political sphere. And Wilson's progressive disciples advocate the same thing today. President Barack Obama wrote in his memoir, The Audacity of Hope, that there is no such thing as absolute truth. And the American people elected him to the presidency twice. And now that Obama's vice president sits in the Oval Office, the left is losing no time in its quest to cast truth to the ground. Scripture shows that the devil has a plan to blot out the name of Israel, and canceling Sir Isaac Newton and other British and American heroes is part of this malevolent plan. God will allow this attack to continue in one form or another until all nations accept the notion that there are universal, absolute, moral, and physical laws that apply to all people for all time in all places.
Well, thank you for that, Andrew. I really appreciate that report. It's a profound look at this subject. I think the people who made that specific decision, that prep school that said we want to stop referring to these laws as Newtonian laws, Newtonian physics, we're just going to describe them as the basic laws of physics. They're looking at it. They're saying explicitly this is a race issue. But you go back and you look at what Woodrow Wilson was saying, and you realize there really is a lot more to this. We're talking about going after a fundamental worldview, a way of looking at how the world works, that the absolutes that Newton based his study of science on are under attack, not just his skin color.
Right. Yeah, I think probably a lot of the people who did make that decision about calling them the laws of physics instead of the Newtonian laws was more of a knee-jerk reaction against white people. But like I said, if you take a deeper philosophical look into the origins of Western civilization, like Wilson did, you can see there that the idea that you're almost losing whiteness as a proxy for canceling Western civilization. And this idea that, like I said, you've got this civilization that's at least striving towards discovering absolute truth, like Isaac Newton did. And so you just start throwing that out, and it does give you some pretty deep insight into like some of the just crazy hysterical things you hear from the radical left today, where I quoted Barack Obama's book where he said there's no such thing as absolute truth, and then right. But you'll see other sources, like I don't know, the Guardian comes to mind, but really any like left-wing media source, they start talking about like my truth, this is my truth, that like truth is something subjective to the individual, which is why if you were to take a Newtonian look at a topic like gender, you'd be like, do you have a Y chromosome or do you not? Mm-hmm. You either have one or you don't. And if you have one, you're a man. And if you don't, you're a woman. And so, but now you'll have like Facebook puts like 52 different genders, and they're like, well, what do you identify as? That's definitely what you'd call a subjective as opposed to an objective truth. Right. It's like, what do I feel like I am? That's, I mean, maybe you've convinced yourself that's true in your mind, but as an objective reality, it's like, what molecular structure do you have at the chromosome level? Yeah. You're denying. That'd be a really good example of like, yeah, the Newtonian idea that like absolute truth is real and the universe is governed according to rational, understandable laws.
Which that is the basis of scientific thought. You alluded to this irony that the left is so quick to attack conservatives for being anti-science. And they uphold this idea that they're just following the science, that it's objective truth that's leading them to all of their conclusions. But the reality is they're rejecting absolutes in so many cases. They're reaching those conclusions based on other criteria, and they're rejecting the basis of actual science.
Right. I mean, probably the two biggest examples you'll hear like a progressive leftist accuse a conservative of being anti-science is evolution and climate change. And in even in those two cases, the fact, like we'll take evolution, for example, the fact that like the proteins in a gene could increase in molecular complexity breaks every known law of entropy known to physics. I actually have a book, pretty good one, entitled Genetic Entropy, that talks about, like, the laws of physics say that a closed system always tends towards a state of order to a state of disorder unless it's being influenced by some outside force. Mm-hmm. And the, like, neo-Darwinian theory that, like, mutation creates new genes and natural selection selects the best of them breaks every law of entropy that Newton wrote about or discovered. Same with climate change. They talk about, like, okay, well, increasing carbon in the atmosphere is going to warm the Earth to an unnatural extent and bring about the collapse of our society within 12 years. We're like, okay, well, that one you can be a little more understanding with, because, like, it is shown that carbon dioxide does have an insulating effect on the atmosphere, but none of the models that those scientists use take into the effect that the insulating effects of carbon aren't linear. The first 20 parts per million in the atmosphere warms it almost as much as the next 400, and that 400 warms it more than the next more than 400 parts. It's logarithmic. So you're vastly exaggerating the effects of climate change for a political end. And, like I said, just an objective look at scientific fact should tell you that. But they use those two things to, like, accuse conservatives and Republicans of being anti-science, and then jump right off the bandwagon with the ideas that, like, race is a social construct, gender is a social construct. You can stop a COVID-19 pandemic if you wear a mask on the 10-foot walk from the restaurant door to your table. Just things like that. That it's like, has anyone thought this through? Even climate change. I think I was mentioned that someone the other day about, like, they're like, oh, well, you need to, like, reduce the carbon emissions from your vehicle by putting ethanol in the gas you get at the gas station. You're like, all right, well, where's the ethanol come from? They make it from corn. I'm like, well, how do you grow corn? It's like, well, you put synthetic fertilizer on the soil. Like, what do you make the fertilizer from? It's like, well, natural gas. It's like, well, if you'd have just put the natural gas on the car in the first place, you'd have saved yourself a bunch of time and trouble for basically the same outcome.
Yeah. It's a fascinating subject. I think the quote that you had from Woodrow Wilson, I'm no fan of Woodrow Wilson. He definitely had some insight when he was talking about the Constitution being written in a Newtonian universe and how he viewed it in a Darwinian universe and felt like it was a living organism that he was predating Al Gore with the living Constitution idea. And it's pretty remarkable insight that he had, that spelling it out the way that he did.
Yeah, that is the one thing I do, like I said, kind of admire about Woodrow Wilson, is that, like, I don't agree with his political theories, but he thought them out well, and he was honest about what he believed.
Where, like, honest about how bad they are.
Right, where a lot of, like, leftists today, I don't know, like Nancy Pelosi specifically comes to mind, is far more radical than Woodrow Wilson, but does it well in the name of protecting the Constitution from Donald Trump, where someone like Woodrow Wilson would have been a little bit more forthright into saying that, like, no, we just need to, like, have a evolving constitution. So at least you know where he stood.
Yeah. Very interesting. We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about the radical left attacking one of the founders of modern scientific thought, and this difference between Newtonian worldview and a Darwinian worldview. He's written an article about this, Why the Left Hates Sir Isaac Newton. You can find that at thetrump.com. Thanks so much, Andrew.
Oh, thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
The Southeast Asian nation of Myanmar is under the rule of a military junta that has killed hundreds of innocent people, and it's attracting interest from great powers within Asia, as we will now hear in this report from Rufara Manyepa.
Myanmar, also known as Burma, attained independence from Britain in 1948. Since then, leadership has vacillated between military rule and civilian leadership. The military, however, remained the most powerful institution throughout this era, and whenever democracy threatened its power, the military would wrest control. In 2011, however, the military finally allowed meaningful change. A type of hybrid democracy emerged and flourished. But last November, civilian leader Aung San Suu Kyi won presidential elections by a landslide, and the military's party garnered only 7% of the vote. This alarmed Myanmar's generals, prompting them to seize control of the government on February 1st and place Suu Kyi and senior members of her party under house arrest. The resulting protests and dissent against the military were met with a brutal crackdown. On March 27th, for example, Ai Myat Thu had just received a coconut slice from her father, and as she walked away from him toward the perimeter of their property, a bullet struck her left temple. Within an hour, she was dead. She was just 10 years old. Over 48 children, more than 700 unarmed citizens across the country have been killed so far. And beyond the killings, over 2,800 people have been arrested. And the military regime has even imposed a nightly curfew. And there are no signs that the situation is about to get better. Just last Friday alone, 82 people were killed. And while the West denounces the military takeover, Russia is not letting the crisis go to waste. It has stepped in and is actually strengthening ties with the Southeast Asian nation. 3 weeks ago, for example, Myanmar invited 8 Asian countries to attend its Armed Forces Day parade. While the other invited countries sent low-level delegates, Russian President Vladimir Putin sent Alexander Fomin, his deputy defense minister. And the delegates watched as the military junta paraded tanks, missiles, and Russian-made combat jets into the capital. This also happened to be the same day that security forces gunned down 10-year-old Ai Myat Thu and at least 114 other people with weapons and arms also from Russia. Now, Russia and China have been discouraging sanctions on Myanmar, saying that they could escalate tensions even as they continue to sell weapons to the military government. And because Russia is geographically so distant from Myanmar, it has very little to lose from supporting the junta. It doesn't have to worry about the fallout and doesn't have to deal with the refugee crisis that would result from all this. And offering support to this violent regime shunned by the rest of the world presents an excellent opportunity for Russia to build both financial and political capital. Now, Moscow is not as diplomatically close to Myanmar as China is, but ever since being on the receiving end of Western sanctions following its 2014 annexation of Crimea, Moscow has been actively looking to deepen its economic and political ties with Asian countries. Myanmar's vast natural resources allowed its first military regime to survive decades of sanctions. As of last year, it held about $6 billion in foreign reserves. And with its strategic location at the trijunction of East, South, and Southeast Asia, it is a potentially crucial hub of regional connectivity. That's part of the reason Russia is readily capitalizing on this opportunity to join its close ally China in entrenching itself in Myanmar. The conflict-ridden nation is a prime opportunity for Putin to extend his reach in Asia. For years now, the trumpet has watched Putin's growing influence in the region, and his power-grabbing moves represent the fulfillment of the early phases of Bible prophecies detailing his rise. In Revelation 9, verse 16, the Apostle John records a prophecy about an army with 200 million soldiers, and he names this army the Kings of the East in verse 12 of Revelation 16. Ezekiel 38 shows the makeup of this gargantuan military bloc and who leads it. It says, "Son of man, set your face against Gog of the land of Magog, the prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal, and prophesy against him, and say, Thus says the Lord God, Behold, I am against you, O Gog, the prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal." Gog here refers to Russia, and the land of Magog refers to a vast Eurasian stretch of land that includes China and other Asian nations. Meshech and Tubal are ancient names for the Russian cities Moscow and Tobolsk. And in his booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia, our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, explains who will fulfill the role of the Prince of Rosh. He wrote that Rosh was the ancient name of Russia, once called Rus, and many encyclopedias and commentaries recognize this. So who is this Prince of Russia? Moscow and Tobolsk? The use of all three names states that this is an individual ruler of all the peoples of Russia, from the west to the east. And when you study these scriptures alongside current events revealing modern Moscow's imperialist direction, you see that Russian President Vladimir Putin could well be the Prince of Rosh. We strongly believe that he is. Can you think of any other Russian politician who would become so powerful and have the will to lead Russia into the crisis of crises? I see nobody else on the horizon who could do that, and only a tiny few years remain for the Prince of Rosh to appear. Such a man doesn't appear overnight. It takes years for a strong-willed leader to gain such control. Vladimir Putin already has the power and the will to use it. He already solidly allied Russia with China. And the prophecy about the Prince of Russia includes that main alliance. Now, other nations are leaning towards an alliance with Russia as well. Several of them are actually prophesied to join. And Myanmar could well be one of those nations. Russia is certainly on a charm offensive, advocating for the military junta, sending a top delegate to its armed forces parade, and continuing arms sales to Myanmar. Now you look at this brutal regime in Myanmar, and it is a throwback to autocratic regimes of the past. Stalinist Russia is one such regime. And the fact that Putin is willing to support Myanmar's violent military is a warning about the nature of this Asian alliance he is prophesied to lead. It will be a violent coalition, and it will bring about unparalleled brutality. But even amidst all of this prophesied darkness, there is hope. And to fully understand these prophecies and the hope that lies ahead, please read our Trends article, Why the Trumpet Watches a Russian Strongman Dominating Asia, and request your free copy of Mr. Fleury's booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia.
Thank you very much for that, Rufaro. You mentioned Myanmar gaining independence back in 1948 and going back and forth between military rule and civilian rule. How much traction have the democratic elements within this country gained there? How strong, for example, were these recent protests against the crackdown on the democratically elected government?
The fact that the military only garnered 7% of the vote in the most recent elections shows you just how popular democracy is today in Myanmar. In the protests that have been happening, there have been cases where over a million people were out in the streets protesting and demonstrating against the military takeover. It's incredibly popular. Celebrities are out there in Myanmar protesting as well. Quite a few of them have been arrested as well. All over the country, everyone has overwhelmingly been in support of the movement towards democratic government. And that's the reason why the military has just been so overwhelmingly brutal in the face of it. And I think even up to this point, people are being arrested for even speaking to journalists. You know, they're trying to get the word out there. Dozens of people have been arrested for speaking to journalists. About 56 journalists themselves have been arrested in the crackdown that's been happening. It's almost like it's the entire country coming up against the military. You know, the vast majority are fighting against these few who have overwhelming force on their side.
So it really is remarkable just how willing Russia and China are to support that military regime in the face of that kind of popular opposition. But it does give you a sense of just what kind of regimes there are governing those countries. They're not at all opposed to those kinds of authoritarian tactics.
Well, this is the true face of autocracy that we're seeing in Myanmar. You know, it's unrepentant, it's unapologetically violent. And, you know, after the 82 people were killed last Friday, one spokesman for the military came out and said that you should all be thankful because the military has actually been exercising restraint so far. Mm. And as a matter of fact, many more people could have died if we wished for them to die. And he just so callously threw out the fact that these 500 people who have died so far, or however many it was at that point, they only died because we weren't using automatic machine guns. Mm-hmm. It would have been that same number in hours and not over the course of this entire coup, you know. And they don't care. And the fact that Russia and China are happy to support such a government that comes out and says things like this, It really puts things into perspective about what autocracy really is and where this world really is headed with powers like Russia and China supporting Myanmar right now.
Is there any sense at this point in how effective the military crackdown has been on suppressing further protests on that scale?
To their credit, the people in Myanmar are still coming out there and they're trying to get the word out as much as they can, but it is starting to take a toll when you think of parents who have their 10-year-old daughters killed like that. It really is a strong deterrent against going out to protest, and the numbers have slowly been decreasing. They're still trying to get out there, and they're trying to use social media when they can, when the curfews aren't imposed and when the internet isn't being blocked. Mm-hmm. But it does look like the numbers are just starting to impact the people there.
So we don't hear much about this nation, but 54 million people right at the heart of Southwest Asia, borders India and China. Talk more about that Kings of the East prophecy and how Myanmar could end up being an important part of that political and military entity.
The pure fact of Myanmar's natural resources makes it so important to this military coalition, because as everyone knows, wars cost money. And the fact that these Kings of the East are going to be waging such a massive war, the fact that they are going to be a part of a 200 million man army, it's going to need a lot of funding behind it. And I think it's really impressive that Myanmar's banks came out in the green after decades of facing sanctions. Now imagine that they're part of this Russian and Asian and Chinese military alliance, and they've got that financial backing, especially with their location between East, South, and Southeast Asia. A lot of goods, a lot of services, a lot of military equipment and natural resources passing through the entire the entire region there through Myanmar is going to be really beneficial for this military alliance. And you can see it as just being a sort of gateway for the interconnectivity of that alliance. And it's going to prove quite crucial, I think, in just making sure that all of those parties involved in that alliance are able to really commit to the war effort in a united way.
Well, I appreciate that. We've been talking with trumpet writer Rufaro Manyepa about the military junta that has overtaken Myanmar. He's written an article titled "Russia Throws Its Weight Behind Myanmar Coup." You can find that at thetrumpet.com. Thanks so much for your time.
Always a pleasure, sir.
It's time for today's last word.
Some years ago, I spent a day at my oldest daughter's elementary school, and I learned a lot about human nature. This school operates a program that invites students' fathers to be on campus throughout the day, serving as an extra pair of eyes, scoping the halls for potential threats, an extra set of hands helping in the classrooms. It's a great program. I witnessed some pretty impressive things in some of the classrooms. One teacher had her fourth graders breaking down sentences grammatically with jaw-dropping precision. As a group, they were reciting rules about semantic gradability and inflectional morphology, whatever those are. I'm trying to figure out how inexpensive it would be to hire myself a 9-year-old grammar tutor. In other classrooms, however, far less learning was going on. As teachers instructed, private conversations bubbled. Practically any distraction derailed students from the task at hand. Students spoke out, apparently, whenever thoughts popped into their heads, even rude ones. I'm no expert in elementary education, but I think I can distill the difference between the fruitful and the unfruitful classrooms down to one single factor: the teacher's determination to confront bad behavior. You put a bunch of kids together, and you're bound to see some bad behavior. It may start small, but if it isn't confronted, it spreads. A child talks while the teacher is instructing. If nothing happens, the next kid thinks, huh, I guess it's okay to do that. So he talks too. Some other kid thinks, well, if he can do that, then I'll do this. And in no time, the room sounds like Grand Central Station. Sometimes I think children are hardwired to continue getting louder until someone tells them enough. The truth is, they're getting louder specifically to test how long it takes before someone tells them enough. The teacher with the fortitude to truly confront the problem can quickly transform the unruliness into ruliness. Dr. Albert Siegel once wrote, "When it comes to rearing children, every society is only 20 years away from barbarism. 20 years is all we have to accomplish the task of civilizing the infants who are born into our midst each year. These savages know nothing of our language, our culture, our religion, our values, our customs of interpersonal relations. The barbarian must be tamed if civilization is to survive." Well, that's a bit dramatic, but in a sense, it is painfully true. Calling children savages certainly reflects reality far better than treating them like natural-born saints or sages or savants. Our human nature represents a savage within each of us that must be civilized, and children have it in spades unless we are diligent in confronting it. That's why Proverbs 29:15 says, "The rod and reproof give wisdom, but a child left to himself brings his mother to shame." Where this reality truly smacked me in the face was on the playground at my daughter's school. I spent 3 recesses outside with first graders, then second graders, then fifth graders. Each successive mob was worse behaved. The fifth graders, having lived more years without being properly civilized, were genuine specimens of savagery. Everywhere I turned, I saw carnality on parade: name-calling, accusing, cursing, screaming, boasting, pushing, sulking, cheating. I realized that most of these same kids had just been inside under the authority of effective, qualified teachers who had managed to keep a lid on all this ugliness through productive, focused work. The level of human nature suddenly on display correlated precisely with the lack of government in their lives at that moment. Take a good student out of the structure of a disciplined classroom and turn him loose with 60 other kids and virtually no supervision, and you have Lord of the Flies. I've noticed the same dynamic at work in my own home. Every time my family gets overly busy, and I in particular begin letting events overtake us, the savages begin their parade. If my wife and I aren't really paying attention, it gets louder and uglier until it's too obvious to ignore and we step in with a firm enough. That's not the way God intended family to be. Yet it may not be exaggerating to say that this form of child training, it's ignore the barbarians until they drive you mad, it's probably the number one method employed in the Western world today. I'm still trying to figure out how elementary school educators believe that allowing children a half hour of barbarism on the playground to break up the day helps round them out. There's much to be said for maintaining a steady presence of civilizing forces in our children's lives. Activities, instruction, discipline, reading, games, work, chores, crafts, charts, schedules, rewards, punishments, supervision. Kids crave structure. And when it isn't there, they act out until they get it. And when they get it, it frees them up to achieve some amazing things. Now, don't get me wrong. Family isn't boot camp. It doesn't necessarily take enormous effort to steer clear of pandemonium in favor of structured or even lightly supervised play. And it's not that children shouldn't be given enough room to make mistakes. We don't want to get in a negative cycle of criticizing them for every word or deed that proves that they are what they are, little people who aren't yet civilized. We need to make sure the overall message we're sending is a positive one. When we do things decently and in order, the way God does, life is happier, it's more fun, it's more rewarding in every way. As our children grow, the responsibility for structuring their lives and bridling themselves must gradually shift onto their own shoulders. They need to practice at civilizing the savage within. Otherwise, the moment they're on their own, they're going to turn into big versions of the fifth graders on that playground. And if you want to know what that looks like, visit an American university. The task of civilizing the infants born into our midst is crucial, and it is great. 20 years is all we have. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Richard Palmer, Andrew Miller, and Rufaro Manyepa. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Winston Churchill. Knowledge of the past is the only foundation we have from which to peer into and try to measure the future. Expert knowledge, however indispensable, is no substitute for a generous and comprehending outlook upon the human story, with all its sadness and with all its unquenchable hope. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.